Pale Fire, a poem in heroic couplets of 999 lines, divided into four cantos. Composed by John Francis Shade, born July 5th, 1898, died July 21st, 1959. Composed during the last 20 days of his life. The manuscript in my possession, mostly a fair copy, consists of 80 medium-sized index cards. All 80 are safe in my possession, on each of which Shade reserved the pink upper line for headings and used the 14 light blue lines for writing with a fine nib in a minute, tidy, remarkably clear hand, the text of his poem, which now I will begin slowly, closely to read. No more skimming. No breathless, hurried back of the class searching in the back of a taxicab, a hired car, on a train, an escalator, for keywords. Slow, careful, close reading. I was the shadow of the waxwing slain by the false azure in the windowpane. Ah, yes, there it is. The authentic Shadian music, I can hear it in his own wise and homely voice. I was the shadow of the waxwing slain.
I was the shadow of the waxwing slain by the false azure in the windowpane. I was the smudge of ashen fluff, and I lived on, flew on, in the reflected sky. And from the inside, too, I duplicate myself, my lamp, an apple on a plate. Uncurtaining the night, I'd let dark glass hang all the furniture above the grass. And how delightful when a fall of snow covered my glimpse of lawn and reached up so as to make a chair and bed exactly stand upon that snow, out in that crystal land.
That crystal land. My crystal land. Yes. My Zimbla. It is here. It is here. Of course, it had to be. Transfigured, of course, recreated by a genius. But here, that distant northern land. Zimbla. A corruption, please note, not of the Russian Zimbla, not of the Russian at all. It derives from the medieval Zimblan, Zimberland, meaning land of resemblers, of reflections. Capital on Hava, meaning far away. Entire peninsula divided north to south by the Biera Range, a few peaks of which rise to 7,000 feet. From the highest, Mount Glitterantine, one can distinguish on only the clearest of days, far out to the east, beyond the Gulf of Surprise, a dim iridescence. That is Russia, that iridescent dimness. Last king of Zimbla, Charles Xavier Siaslav, reigned 1936 to 1958, a peaceful and elegant reign, as historians, those of discernment, of imagination. Harmony was that reign's password. The polite arts and pure sciences flourished. The poor got a little richer and the rich a little poorer. Taxation had become a thing of beauty. Parachuting became a popular sport. Even the climate seemed to be improving. Charles Xavier Vsieslav. Charles the Beloved.
Retake the falling snow, each drifting flake shapeless and slow, unsteady and opaque, a dull dark white against the day's pale white, and abstract larches in the neutral light. And then the gradual and dual blue, as night unites the viewer and the view, and in the morning diamonds of frost express amazement. Whose spurred feet have crossed from left to right the blank page of the road? reading from left to right in winter's code, a dot, an arrow pointing back. A pheasant's feet. Torquated beauty, sublimated grouse, finding your china right behind my house. Was he in Sherlock Holmes, the fellow whose tracks pointed back when he reversed his shoes? All colors made me happy, even gray. My eyes were such that literally they took
gray.
Photographs.
Happy, even gray. Happy, even gray. And line 17, and then the gradual. Gradual, gray, gray, gradus. Coincidence? You knew little of Gradus, John. Did I even tell you his name? You saw him only once for a moment, a fatal moment. And then he could have been little more than a shadow to you. Which is what he is. A shadow. A grubby, cretinous, minor shadow. And an assassin. When reading, no doubt, he moves his lips as he climbs down those difficult columns of print. He has tried several times to castrate himself. He's endowed with a modicum of self-awareness and with a willingness to kill, not for pleasure. We might concede he takes no pleasure in murder. But if so appointed, so assigned, he will kill. He will cross half the world to kill. And he was so appointed, so assigned, and so began his steady blundering through two hemispheres on the very night John Francis Shade began the first canto of Pale Fire.
I cannot understand why from the lake I could make out our front porch when I'd take Lake Road to school, whilst now, although no tree has intervened, I look but fail to see even the roof. Maybe some quirk of space has caused a fold or furrow to displace the fragile vista, the frame house between Goldsworth and Wordsmith on its square of green. I had a favorite young shagbark there, with ample dark jade leaves and a black, spare vermiculated trunk. The setting sun bronzed the black bark around which, like undone garlands, the shadows of the foliage fell. It is now stout and rough. It has done well. White butterflies turn lavender as they pass through its shade, where gently seems to sway the phantom of my little daughter's swing. The house itself is much the same.
Perhaps I ought to give some information about my own circumstances in that Appalachian campus town of New Y, John Shade's hometown, where in the house in which he was born he wrote at the age of 61, Pale Fire. I was there for only 7 months. I moved into the house next door to the Shades in February 59, only 7 months ago. Dulwich Road, on the edge of town, on the verge of wood and farmland. An old white and black half-timbered place, which I rented from Hugh Warren Goldsworth, distinguished judge, authority in Roman law. He had gone to England on a long sabbatical, and I have never yet met the man. It has been said he bears a strong resemblance to my neighbor, the equally distinguished poet. I cannot say, just as I will not say anything about the ridiculous stories about the supposedly terrifying shadows the judge's gown threw across the underworld, about this or that gray lunatic beast lying in prison and dying of ragdirst. Zimblan, thirst for revenge. I had little contact with the Shades in the first few weeks. With John, of course, I could exchange a word or two in the corridors and dining hall of Wordsmith University, where he and I both taught. Sybil, his wife, no exchange at all.
Both, of course, great respecters of privacy, their own and others. Assumed I wish to be left alone. One must assume. I saw them here and there, of course. From my second-story window. From the corner at the end of my veranda. While strolling in the garden from behind a tulip tree, I could see several bright windows. He never pulled down the shades. She did. And once, by chance, trying to isolate a most peculiar bird from a distance the double of our Zemblan Zampel silk tail, my binoculars, for a moment only, brought close a mirror in Joan's upstairs study. In the mirror, a portrait of the artist at work, hunched up shoulders and a pencil. He was picking his ear, and then looking at the lead, and then, did he taste it? However, my first genuine conversation with the delightful old fellow took place late in my first month. Still snow on the ground, I came out of main hall into the pillared porch and found myself standing next to him at the top of the steps. I stood by his side at last and began to put on my gloves.
Professor Shade.
Dr. Kinbot.
A blue-skied day.
White ground, eh? Cold.
February still. The third of the four white nose months, as they call them where I come from. I've long been an admirer of your work, Professor Shade, but I've not yet had a chance to... But 2 decades ago, as long ago as that, I attempted the translation of some of your verses.
Into Russian?
From your second volume, I believe. Knight wrote... A short poem entitled Art. From mammoth hunts and odysseys and oriental charms to the Italian goddesses with Flemish babes in arms.
That was a thorough job. Putting your gloves on, I mean. Finger by finger like that. As if you were waiting to review a regiment.
And you are waiting for your wife to fetch you home.
You're left-handed?
Except in the mirror. If Mrs. Shade doesn't turn up, I'd be glad to give you a lift.
She'll turn up.
I do have to leave right away, and I have to stop on the way for cookies and caviar. A little seminar at home. And then, if the boy's work has been sound, table tennis. 2 charming identical twins and another boy. The other boy is... But I think he attends your course as well as mine. Douglas Carson, a moody, delicate rather... Wonderful boy.
No, I stopped that long ago. A long time since I made any attempt to memorize faces and names of students. Even this semester's blonde in the black leotard. Haven't even learned her name.
Well, I must be going. Good afternoon, Professor Shade, or may I call you John? We are neighbors as well as colleagues. I'm Charles.
All right, Charlie.
Charlie. Why not?
Afternoon, then, Charlie.
I hope you're not abandoned here too long. The street lamps are coming on.
Street lamps are numbered, and maybe number 999, so brightly beaming through a tree so green, is an old friend of mine.
The Nature of Electricity, New York Magazine, August 58. You see, neighbor John, I do know your work. And I know you like to walk. I see you go out alone, eager as a clever boy, and then I see you come back 2-3 hours later. It would be an honor, a joy indeed, to share a walk or two with you, and I might have something grand, John, to share with you.
And so it began. By the summer, we were indeed walking together, my poet and I, on weekday evenings and on a few, too few, Sunday afternoons. See us walk together, the cosmopolitan scholar and the fireside poet with his odd little shuffling lopsided gait, while the scholar must restrain his long athletic stride. And the scholar feeds the poet. He feeds him material for a masterpiece, the dazzling Ziembla burning in my brain. I mesmerize, I saturate him with my vision, my images to be shaped by his genius. I press them on him with a drunkard's generosity. I will do so till he is ripe and full with my Ziembla, ripe enough to spurt at the brush of an eyelash. On these walks, or over a game of chess with my poet on my porch, I felt in my bones that there was a chance after all of heaven for me, of salvation granted after all, after all, after all, the frozen mud in my heart.
Now, the father of Charles Xavier, Charles the Beloved, was King Alphine. Born 1873, died 1918, reigned 1900 to 1918, known, most affectionately known, as Alphine the Vague. He fell now and then, you see, into naive fits of abstraction. One story will illustrate.
Old Hensner's farm is just through there. Dead 7 years now. And I still miss him.
King Charles, alas, can't be said to miss his father. Only three when left fatherless. Poor boy.
He knew the names of things, you see, old Hensner. Trees, grasses, flowers, butterflies. Vanessa, Diana, admirable. To put a name to a thing. The right and only word.
This story hinges on two words. The summer before the First World War, the Austrian Emperor paid a visit to Ziembla, a most unusual, most flattering visit to our tiny nation. And one afternoon... You want to rest a while?
No. No. Let's walk on.
So, one afternoon, little King Alphine took this European giant for a spin in his brand new custom-built motor car. A jaunt in the countryside, no escort. Alphine went often with no escort. Just the king and the emperor and the Ziemblen interpreter. On the way back, the engine began to shudder and then it stopped. This didn't trouble Alphine. He was a happy tinkerer. So while the emperor and the interpreter rested in the shade of some pines, the king spent a perfectly contented half hour with his head under the bonnet. When he finally got back to Anhava, to the palace, he was met with wails and frantic questions. And then King Alphine delivered what is his only recorded bon mot. He said, "What emperor?"
Very good, Charlie. Very good. This here's a shagbark, a kind of hickory. Caria alba. But shagbark's the right word. There's one in my backyard. Known it since we were lads together.
I have other things to tell you, John.
I'm sure you do.
More than anecdote. Exalted things. Sublime things. And one high, deep, secret thing. I am not here. I am not here. Oh. How did you find me?
This is where you're living? A motel room?
Professor Hurley.
You look unwell, Charles. Unwell and distracted.
Professor Hurley, I am here to do important work, here to be undisturbed. And how did you find me?
We know you're a secretive man.
I am a private man.
Indeed. We found out you had all your mail delivered to your office, none at all to your house.
These suburban homes have open letterboxes out on the road. They become crammed with idiotic advertisements, and letters may be purloined.
Purloined?
Professor Hurley.
You went to see Jane Provost, John's old secretary.
Yes. For information only she could provide, or only she would deign to provide.
About John?
Of course. I am editing his final masterpiece, which is in large part autobiographical, to make my commentary as full and accurate as possible. His wife certainly would share nothing.
Sybil, too, is a private person, as was John. However, Jane Provost, you questioned her and she talked.
I conducted a long, detailed, polite, and sympathetic interview.
She would have loved that with Jane. She always loved to talk, which is why she hadn't been John's secretary for years.
It was John's earlier life I was interested in.
And she gave you information, and you said you'd be happy to hear more. So you gave her this address, and we got it from her. Not too clever for such a privately busy man who wants to be undisturbed.
And who is this we who find things out and trick addresses from people?
John Shade's friends, his wife's friends, John's publisher of 20 years, and Sybil's lawyer.
And you? Why are you here?
A committee has been formed. The Shade Committee. I am its chairman. And I have been appointed to edit and oversee the publication of Pale Fire, with the full-hearted approval of Sybil Shade.
You? I already have a contract with the woman.
Yes, well, Sybil admits she may have scrawled her name on something you put before her, but she was hardly in her right mind then, was she?
The signature may be tremulous, but it's unmistakably that of Sybil Shade, to whom all profits will accrue. The document is properly witnessed, legal and binding.
Listen to me. Sybil is now very much in her right mind, and I'm to edit the poem. I am the head of the English department at Wordsmith University, John Shade's University. I have been John's friend for almost 30 years. No one is more familiar with his work.
Yes, you're head of the department. A perfectly adequate administrator, but an inept scholar. And while John was working on that poem, and for a while before he began, he had no better friend than me.
For God's sake, man, John hadn't set eyes on you until a few months ago.
So the calendar might say, but there are friendships which have their own inner duration, their own eons of time, transparent time, beyond the understanding of any committee.
Dear me, you are unwell.
I wish you to leave now.
Dr. Kinbode, where is John's poem?
I insist you leave now.
Where is the poem, which, let us not forget, may not be finished?
Ha! And there you display your committee-minded ineptitude. Pale Fire is finished. There is a clarion of internal evidence ringing through Canto 4. Canto 3 is penultimate. John called it so himself, to me, on one of our rambles. Even the Sybil wouldn't dare prophesy a fifth. On the very night he finished his work, on our way to my house for tokay, a neckle of walnuts, large tomatoes, and a bunch of bananas in my house, he told me he would read aloud the entire work, the entirely finished work, to me. First of all, to me, Pale Fire is complete. And so little of Zembla it contains. So very little of palace and revolution, of love and grief, and hellish dreams of heaven, of escape. So little of the story of Charles the Beloved. And yet I detect... What? The sunset glow of that story? Yes, a symptomatic family resemblance in the coloration of both poem and tale. Wavelets of fire, pale phosphorescent hints, subliminal debts to me. Debt indeed. Echoes and spangles of my mind, a long ripple wake of glory.
A thread of subtle pain, tugged at by playful death, released again, but always present, ran through me. One day, when I'd just turned 11, as I lay prone on the floor and watched a clockwork toy, a tin wheelbarrow pushed by a tin boy, bypass chair legs and stray beneath the bed. There was a sudden sunburst in my head.
It would seem that as a boy, Shade suffered from a mild form of epilepsy every day for several weeks until nature repaired the damage. My own boyhood was too happy and robust to contain anything like such fainting fits. And perhaps I should note here that, by a stroke of luck, I have seen that clockwork toy. It was in John's basement where we were rummaging like playmates for something entirely different. On a dusty shelf between a candlestick and a handless clock. He brushed the dust off it with his sleeve and muttered something about a strangeness that came over him one day while playing with this. The boy was a little negro of painted tin with a keyhole in his side and no breadth to speak of, just two fused profiles. His wheelbarrow was now all bent and broken.
There was a sudden sunburst in my head, and then black night. That blackness was sublime.
And Gradus, too, is here, of course. He was here all along, with every line Shade wrote, making his way from Piney Zimbla to Hickory d'Appalachia, through the entire length of the poem, following the road of its rhythm, riding past in a rhyme, skidding around the corner of a run-on, hiding between two words, swinging down to the foot of the page from line to line, moving ever nearer, in iambic motion, going into a hotel, putting out the bedlight while Shade blots out a word. Gradus falls asleep in a blackness far from sublime, the blackness of slime, as the poet lays down his pen.
My husband's poem.
And where, Mrs. Shade, is my plan of the palace?
What plan? What palace?
What palace? What plan? And have a palace, a meticulous drawing of which I prepared for your husband to help him in his work.
On pale fire?
Of course.
I fail to see how such a thing would be of any help to John.
That he, too, failed to see its value is, of course, to be regretted. But it is of immense value to me. It is to be reproduced in my edition of Pale Fire. And I have neither the time nor the energy for the mnemonic effort and eye strain the drawing of another would entail.
Dr. Kinbooks.
My headaches would become even more excruciating with so many chambers and terraces, bastions and pleasure grounds and all sorts of heraldic devices, all sorts. Would you care to sit down anywhere but at my desk?
No, thank you.
So, I wish to beg you, Mrs. Shade, very humbly, without raising my voice, to return said plan to me, well packed, marked not to be bent, and by registered mail.
I don't recall ever having seen this drawing.
It should be easily found. It's on a large piece of cardboard, 30 inches by 20, done in ink of several colors. In mid-July, it was on top of the big black trunk opposite the old mangle in the corridor leading to what you, for some reason, call your fruit room. There is, I seem to recall, a stuffed fox or coyote in the corner near this trunk.
May I sit down?
The invitation remains open.
May I smoke? Thank you. Would you care for one?
The very occasional Turkish for me, nothing else. Certainly not American. I can offer you a glass of bottled water, chilled, an apple?
Nothing, thanks. John and I used to rather enjoy staying in motels. In younger days, aimless travels. Dr. Kinbooks.
Mrs. Shade.
I came here to confirm, so there'd be no doubt at all, that I want Paul Hurley to edit and oversee the publication of my husband's poem.
He of the Shade Committee.
Yes, well, I'm not keen on that idea myself. I can hear John laugh at the notion. But Professor Hurley is the right man for the job.
No, Mrs. Shade. That man is I. Only I can reveal the underside of the weave of that masterpiece, without which its full meaning cannot be comprehended.
What underside?
And there is the matter of our contract.
I know. I signed some.
Indeed you did. Countersigned by me and witnessed by my gardener.
I scarcely remember. That night, that very night, Dr. Kinbooks.
I admit, you were distraught.
Destroyed?
And some might argue overcome by grateful grief at my having tried to save John's life. But the fact remains, I did try to save your husband's life, and the contract too remains. I defy any serious examiner to find it unbinding.
May I see it?
It's in my publisher's safe.
Do you own a gun, Dr. Kimbode?
A gun?
Some months ago, I saw you. I thought I saw you in your garden, close to our fence, by the tulip tree.
You may have seen me there. I was sometimes there.
Long after midnight.
Perhaps. Insomnia plagues me as much as the migraine does.
I was sure, almost sure. You had a shotgun in your hands.
Yes, the judge's weapon, Judge Goldsworth. I thought I'd had a prowler, intruder. I have... Yes, we may call it fear. A fear of intruders. You need have no fear of me.
No. I have none. No fear of you at all. You, who often, not one or two insomniac nights, often prowled around our house. You, who spied from your windows with your lights out. You, with your binoculars, creeping from porch to bush to hedge. You're the prowlerkin boat. It's you who intrudes and spies and deceives.
Mrs. Shade.
Despicable spy.
Sybil, please.
The night John read me the passage about Hazel, we were in the back parlor. He was reading me the most wonderful, heartbreaking lines he ever... And you were outside.
Why should I not be? My garden abutted yours.
You were at our window. You knocked over the ashcan lid, eavesdropping creep.
I did not eavesdrop. I heard nothing. I had come over on some friendly mission, neighborly, I forget exactly what. I did no more than catch an accidental glimpse of you and John, both in tears. I thought you were playing cards, and I wondered why such tears.
They were the cards of the poem.
Oh, I know that now. As I know now, he read aloud to you. The poet who never, never showed anything unfinished. His words and yours. So who's the deceiver? You said he would not even discuss it until it was finished. Quite, quite finished. And there he is, reading away like a bedtime daddy.
I am his wife, you damnable fool.
Widow! And certainly there was much he would not discuss. Not with me, not at all. Certainly not with me. A perfect case in point is this daughter of yours, Hazel, of these heart-breaking lines. Most of what I've learned about her came from Jane Provost. To judge from John Shade's conversation, you'd think he'd never had a daughter, but good old Jane came up with the goods. Explained, perhaps, why the girl never was discussed. Very odd and unstable, flabby, feeble, clumsy and solemn, with so-called poltergeist activity. Saucepans crashing to the kitchen floor. The table from Shade's study found standing outside in the snow one morning, knocking and scratching in the night. Mischievous spirit indeed. And then she spends hours in an old barn, studying random light effects, trying to communicate with the dead. The dead. The dead do not communicate. The dead, the gentle dead, who knows? In tungsten filaments abide, and on my bedside table glows another man's departed bride. The Nature of Electricity, John Francis Shade, New York Magazine, August 58.
Charles. She's gone, Charles.
Disa?
Yes.
Disa, there were times, I confess, when I wished he'd have another heart attack.
Oh, Charles, what a thing to wish for.
Not fatal. But serious enough for me to be called over in the middle of the night, the friendliest of neighbors, a great warm burst of sympathy, coffee, telephone calls, Zimblan herbal remedies.
Which work wonders, of course.
And a resurrected Shade weeping in my arms.
Poor Charles.
Why this ghostly communication?
I am alive, Charles. And your wife still.
My queen.
A banished queen.
Deezer, I've no wish to be rude or cruel, but I've no room tonight for other voices in my head. I have this work, you see. This poem to bring to completion.
Your profile has not changed. The glistening teeth biting the careful lip, the shade beneath the eye from the long lashes, the peach down rimming the cheekbone, the dark silky brown of hair brushed up from temple and from nape, the very naked neck, the Persian shape of nose and eyebrow. You have kept it all. And on still nights we hear the waterfall. Come and be worshipped. Come and be caressed, my dark Vanessa, crimson barred, my blessed, my admirable butterfly.
More butterfly stuff. A dusty, tattered moth. Now, could he really see her like this at her age?
We have been married 40 years. At least 4,000 times your pillow has been creased by our two heads.
We are tyrannized today by frenzied heterosexualism. Even our best poets are under that feministic thumb.
And I love you most when, with a pensive nod, you greet her ghost and hold her first toy on your palm, or look at a postcard from her found in a book. She might have been you, me, or some quaint blend. Nature chose me so as to wrench and rend your heart and mine. At first we'd smile and say, all little girls are plump, or Jim McVeigh, the family oculist, will cure that slight squint in no time. And later, she'll be quite pretty, you know, and trying to assuage the swelling torment. That's the awkward age. She should take riding lessons, you would say, your eyes and mine not meeting. She should play tennis or badminton, less starch, more fruit. She may not be a beauty, but she's cute. It was no use. No use.
No use. Faces. Physiognomy. From behind all faces may emerge. I see him. I see him. He is no longer abstract, a shadow invisible. I can see his humid flesh, that bleak oblong of a face, the close-set eyes, sad as a snake's, mesmeric, mineral blue on the jaw, and the gravelly pointee of his nearly mustache, the wart on the chin, the nose with its crooked ridge and grooved tip. He has short, upright black hair, and black hairs coat the backs of his hands, repulsive. Both thumbs slightly deformed. His walk is a chimpanzee slouch, broad body, short hind legs. We might even imagine the magenta and mulberry insides, a strange sea swell undulating in his... Oh, clothe him. Cover him up. Brown suit, brown shoes, a tie of imitation silk, also brown, marred with red, and a brown overcoat, a browning in the pocket, Gratus.
Charles.
Deezer?
Charles, what's wrong?
I can see you.
Good. Now sit down.
The shade beneath the eye. Long lashes.
Please, Charles, sit.
The very naked neck. The Persian shape.
No, tell me what's wrong. Is it your headaches again?
Oh, yes. The migraine is with us always, but more. Something is wrong. Something is very wrong. He described you. How could he do that? He'd never seen you. I never described. How could he make you in 7 lines?
Better now?
Better, yes.
Drink a little more.
I can still see you. But it's not...
What is it not?
I do not hallucinate.
No. I come because you bid me come. I always did, gladly.
You don't look glad. Are you sad?
There's always sadness. Of course there is. We have been married 10 years.
We have to try to understand the king's dilemma. He is 33 years old and has lived almost 20 of those years maintaining with all his dedication and vigor the manly traditions of his country and his status. Zemblan princes and kings, all the nobility in fact, and many a muscular commoner, as all chronicles and folklore attest, have forever inclined in amatory matters to the pagan, the Greek, the virile. They have been androcentric to a man. Charles the Beloved is steeped, immersed, plunged at every opportunity in this ancestral culture. Even the most devout of the clergy tolerate such princely doings. But of course, of dreary course, there is the question of succession, of an heir. So, after an entire night, locked up in the cold vastness of Anhava Cathedral, fervently asking God for guidance and strength, in the autumn of 1949, he takes as his wife and queen 19-year-old Disa and 5 calamitous years go by.
Charles, where are you?
In a chess problem, dear. The king's dilemma.
Charles.
Here I am, sweet lady.
Charles, who are all those boys?
What boys, my queen?
In the rose garden. There are about 12 of them, all in Eton collars. They're singing.
Ah, yes, our little English choir.
English?
Yes, they were recommended to us by our ambassador there.
I loathe that man.
But his taste in music, such sweet voices. It's part, you see, of a new educational plan. The boys see something of another world, new vistas and byways, bracing Zemblan customs, and to them exotic pageant, while we are amused by their sweetness for a week or two. They'll be gone in a fortnight.
Perhaps there are more than 12. 14, perhaps? 1 for each day of your amusing fortnight.
Ah! Once again, the regal display of sarcastic sophistication. That's the spirit. Well done.
You promised, Charles.
I know, but I'm a king. Everywhere I go, temptation stands at attention.
And are you to be the last king of Zimbla? You need an heir, and I need a husband.
You have one.
I need a lover.
Then take one.
I want only you. I love you, and I want a loving husband.
Lisa, I've tried. You know I have. Strenuously.
I have an idea.
Oh, not another idea. We've tried them all. Every aphrodisiac trick in the book. You've played the courtesan and the whimpering virgin.
I am a virgin. Please, Charles, listen to me. We could make it an adventure.
What kind of adventure?
I go to Nice, to my villa there. I leave suddenly, angrily, vowing never to return.
All right, so far.
And then you follow me.
You know I'm not fond of Nice. Some of the people who witter and pose down there.
Listen, you follow me in disguise.
In disguise?
Wouldn't that be an adventure? Wouldn't you relish that? You leave here by night, you escape from your own palace, you travel all those hundreds of miles incognito. You'd be living a Zemblan legend, the king in disguise.
Yes, I could take Odon with me.
Odon?
He's the greatest actor of his generation, a master of disguise, and my dearest chum. A chum's a must for an adventure.
All right. But from Nice, you travel alone. Again by night. To Cap Turk. Along the lane with the oleanders. To Villa Paradiso. Still no announcement. No revelation. You climb the jacaranda tree. If you're spotted, you might be shot. Your blood will be hot. You climb in my window.
It might work.
It must.
If you comply with a certain expedient,
What do you mean?
No matter how hot my blood, one glimpse of the anterior characteristics of your unfortunate sex is bound to put me off.
Oh, dear God.
Even by moonlight. However, your buttocks, and this is a compliment I've paid you before, are deliciously pert and boyish. It's all a question of posture, no?
Charles, if you love me...
But I do not. I cannot. My dear sir, what are you doing? Do get up. Why examine a floor tile? Dear sir, you must have known. I may not have said it before in so many words, but for heaven's sake, woman, surely you knew. Won't you please get up? You look like a charwoman.
I'll get up and carry out the first part of our plan. I'll leave tonight, not angrily, quietly, and go to Nice.
For reasons of health?
If you like. And never return.
And there, in Villa Paradiso with its unclimbed jacaranda, you remain to this day. Diza? Diza? Good. Time for work.
You scrutinized your wrist. It's 8:15, and here time forked. I'll turn it on. The screen in its blank broth evolved a lifelike blur, and music welled. He took one look at her.
Yes, I remember this from my first hurried reading. The poet and the missus at home watching television while the daughter's out on a blind date. Unfortunately, her mystery beau was not blind. Took one look, a slap of the brow, and off to a previous engagement. And now crafty shade will intertwine the two themes. Parents at home, daughter out in the night alone. Synchronization technique.
A male hand traced from Florida to Maine the curving arrows of Aeolian wars. You said that later a quartet of bores, two writers and two critics, would debate the cause of poetry on Channel 8.
Even I used to watch such things in an attempt to stupefy my insomniac, brattling brain.
And then there was a kind of travelogue. A host narrator took us through the fog of a March night, where headlights from afar approached and grew like a dilating star.
Car lights climbing my wall and crossing my ceiling would draw my eyes from the screen. Then I'd have to get up and prowl from window to window looking for prowlers, my silk nightcap drenched with sweat.
Was that the phone? You listened at the door. Nothing.
Solitude is the playfield of Satan.
Picked up the program from the floor. More headlights in the fog. There was no sense in window rubbing, only some white fence, and the reflector poles passed by unmasked.
The ugly duckling in the bus on her way home from her disastrous date. Well, 23 years old, full-grown duck now, really, and headlights in her fog, too. Synchronization.
I think, she said, I'll get off here. It's only Lockenhead. Yes, that's okay. Gripping the stang, she peered at ghostly trees. Bus stopped. Bus disappeared.
Alone in the dark. I was always alone.
There's nothing else of interest. You played network roulette. The dial turned and trekked. Commercials were beheaded. Faces flicked. An open mouth in mid-song was struck out. An imbecile in sideburns was about to use his gun.
Sometimes I wandered the judge's house, armed with the judge's shotgun, praying.
Out of his lakeside shack, a watchman, Father Time, all gray and bent.
Gray. Grados might be lurking in that dark.
Emerged with his uneasy dog and went along the reedy bank. He came too late. You gently yawned and stacked away your plate. We heard the wind. We heard it rush and throw twigs at the window pane. Phone ringing? No.
No comfort. No company. No bright young thing to ring and say, a game tonight, Doc.
I helped you with the dishes. The tall clock kept on demolishing young root, old rock. Midnight, you said. What's midnight to the young? And suddenly a festive blaze was flung across five cedar trunks. Snow patches showed, and a patrol car on our bumpy road came to a crunching stop.
Who might come to my door? Jittery extremists to hustle me off to a moonlit wall.
People have thought she tried to cross the lake at Loch and Neck, where zesty skaters crossed from X to Y on days of special frost.
Muttering thugs bearing off a chloroform scholar.
Others suppose she might have lost her way by turning left from Bridge Road, and some say she took her poor young life. I know. You know.
I knew sometimes that only by self-destruction, forgive me, Jesus, only by that sin could I cheat the assassin who was advancing relentless towards me, in my eardrums, in my pulse, in my skull, which is breaking again.
The lake lay in the mist, its ice half drowned. A blurry shape stepped off the reedy bank into a crackling, gulping swamp and sank.
Say it. Concentrate. Solace in work. Sorry, John, but this passage seems to me labored and overlong, and you must have known the synchronization device has already been done to death by Flaubert and Joyce. Dear, sweet Jesus, do something.
I hope my call didn't disturb you at too crucial a moment. I didn't want to be left hammering on your door again. So, why here?
I've been locked away too long. I wanted to see people.
The duller sort of student. The delinquents, most of them will be in a year or two. You wanted to see these people? Blue jeans, leather jacket, white t-shirt. You find that attractive?
What do you want with me, Professor Hurley?
You know what I want. You know what everyone wants.
I saw your obituary of John.
And?
There are defects.
Well, perhaps. I had to produce it in rather a hurry.
The defects are preposterous. I seem to have learned more about John in a few summer rambles than you have in a lifetime. And as for your understanding of his work...
Yes, Dr. Kinbode and his friend John Shade. Kinbode and John Shade's work. Do you know how Sybil has described your relationship with him? She has called you a monstrous parasite, anagenius, an intestinal worm, elephantine tick. Quite a shady and turn of phrase, don't you think? All this, mind you, while you were still taking those happy rambles with her poor, over-tolerant husband.
Those walks will be resumed elsewhere.
Rambles in paradise?
I doubt we'll meet you there, Professor.
I want to make it clear to you how hopeless your situation is. Sybil is entirely against your involvement, so is the Shade Committee.
At which in heaven John laughs.
Your version of Pale Fire will never be published. It might also interest you to know that your version of events is entirely discredited.
What events?
What events do you think? This man, you say, was trying to find you. You gave a garbled account to Sybil.
There will be a perfectly lucid account in my commentary to Pale Fire.
Which will never be read. The three students from the campus grounds who supposedly directed this man to the library, no recollection. The desk girl in the library, no recollection. And Professor Emerald absolutely did not give anyone a lift to Dulwich Street that night.
The police spoke to them all?
Yes. Why they bothered, I do not know. Thoroughness, I suppose. Duty, Appalachia's finest.
They haven't spoken to me.
They will. Are you fond of a man in uniform? Or is casual delinquent more to your taste?
You are mean of spirit, Professor Hurley. You have a small mind and a tainted one. Your bow tie is absurd. And my version of events, as you call it, will in the end be confirmed and justified and finally understood.
In this world or the next?
Jesus.
You believe in no judge of life, no designer of death?
Life is a great surprise. I don't see why death should not be an even greater one.
But if there is no higher intelligence, no universal mind, first cause, absolute, for all of which I submit God is the proper name, your right and only word, then we're faced with the prospect of all the meaningless chance of this world reaching into the next. Dreadful notion.
I've sensed death sometimes, as a chess knight on a marginal file might sense phantom squares beyond the edge of the board.
There are rules in chess, but the idea of one's soul plunging off the board into a lawless afterlife, chaos, no appeal, no support, no protection.
There may be a guardian angel. If there is, I know the color of her eyes and the butterfly markings of her wings.
We all of us doubt.
The blue of ink flecked with white.
I've been assailed by fearsome doubts in my time, but I had my church to help me fight them off.
No church for me.
Oh, well, the dull Protestantism I've seen in America, John. No wonder people stay away. In Zembla, our Reformation was led by a composer of genius, so our liturgy is suffused with the richest music. And our choir voice...
Do you realize what an extraordinary blend this region is?
Region?
Our part of the state. A blend of Canadian zone and Austral zone. Birds and insects and plants of the north mingled with those of the south. Riches.
And the riches... In your poem?
Coming along.
That's all?
Yep. That's all, folks.
No. Hint?
Nope. Ain't talking.
But coming along.
Nicely, thanks.
Good. Well, as St. Augustine said...
Oh, how many times in my life must I have that man quoted at me?
One cannot know what God is. One can only know what God is not. I know what he is not. He is not despair. He is not terror. He is not earth in a rattling throat, not an assassin in a ghastly brown suit, not relentless, not snake-eyed, not a black hum in my ears fading to nothing. Not nothing. Not nothing.
For we die every day. Oblivion thrives not on dry thigh bones, but on blood-ripe lives, and our best yesterdays are now foul piles of crumpled names, phone numbers, and foxed files. I'm ready to become a floweret or a fat fly, but never to forget. And I'll turn down eternity unless the melancholy and the tenderness of mortal life, the passion and the pain, the claret taillight of that dwindling plane off Hesperus, your gesture of dismay on running out of cigarettes, the way you smile at dogs, the trail of silver slime snails leave on flagstones, this good ink, this rhyme, this index card, this slender rubber band which always forms, when dropped, an ampersand, are found in heaven. By the newly dead, stored in its strongholds through the years.
And original sin?
When I was small, I thought that meant Cain killing Abel.
Isn't it rather disobeying the divine will?
How can I disobey something I don't know, which might not exist?
But you can't deny there are sins.
I can think of only two. Murder and the deliberate infliction of pain. The passport is pity. What are you gazing at?
Your head.
My head.
The mop of gray hair. The bags under the eyes. You sit there holding that head up with a hand whose fingernails are yellow.
My looks ain't grand. I'll give you that.
And inside that head, there occurs an organic miracle. You perceive and transform the world. You produce that miraculous fusion of image and music, a line of verse.
That's grand enough.
That head contains a brain of a different nature from all the synthetic jellies in most of the skulls around us. And yet, you could be taken for a fleshy Hogarthian tippler.
Not bad, Charlie. I've been told I look like four people. Samuel Johnson, that reconstruction of primitive man in the Exton Museum, Judge Goldsworth, your landlord, and one of the women who ladled out the grub in the main hall cafeteria.
And me, John.
Oh, I think you're a one-off, Charlie.
I've been told I resemble King Charles.
That's so.
In disguise. The beard, these clothes.
Well, the lilac slacks might put some folks off the track.
But then, all bearded Zemblans look alike. One of our sillier proverbs.
Not bad. Give me another.
The last glove is happy.
Even better.
Kinbolt, John. It means regicide. And a king who goes through the looking glass incognito into exile, might he not be called a destroyer of a king?
John! Afternoon. Sorry I'm late.
Just in time, Paul. Just in time. Say hello to Charlie. I'll be with you in a minute.
Are we not to have our walk, John?
Not today, Charlie. Another time.
Previous engagement.
Yes. Golf. And how are you, Kinbolt?
Well, thank you.
And how's the lodger?
Lodger?
Young, what's his name? Donnie.
Douglas stayed with me for a short while as my guest, not as a lodger. I gave him a bed and at least one decent meal a day. He had nowhere else to go.
But now he has.
Yes.
Still, at least you have your new gardener for company. That black lad. Quite the strapping young Moor, eh? Can't you just see him in nothing but a turban and those loose-fitting trousers and an ankle bracelet, maybe?
Those trousers are called shalvars. And you, Professor Hurley, are a most disagreeable man.
And what exactly are you? Hello, Sybil.
Hi, Paul.
All right, Paul. We're ready to go. Lead on.
Bye, Sybil.
Talk to you later, Charlie.
You don't play golf, Dr. Kinbolt?
No. Tiresome game.
Not one for sports?
I'm a passable horseman. I ski, I skate, I wrestle. I'm a rock climber, and I parachute.
Really?
There are few thrills the equal of descending under green silk to where a Rolls Royce waits with a shooting stick and a scotch and water.
I'm sure there are not. A Rolls Royce?
Those were different days, Sybil. But I don't play golf.
Would you care for another glass of lemonade?
No, thank you. Previous engagement, I must away to church.
All right. But I thought you'd already attended.
On some Sundays I worship at least twice. It elevates my mind above other Sunday activities like shopping and gossip and golf. Goodbye.
But who can teach the thoughts we should roll call when morning finds us marching to the wall under the stage direction of some goon political, some uniformed baboon? We'll think of matters only known to us.
You and I, John. You and I.
Empires of rhyme, indies of calculus. Listen to distant cocks crow and discern upon the rough, gray wall a rare wall fern. And while our royal hands are being tied, taunt our inferiors, cheerfully deride the dedicated imbeciles, and spit into their eyes just for the fun of it.
Oh, royal fun indeed.
Nor can one help the exile, the old man dying in a motel, with a loud fan revolving in the torrid prairie night, and from the outside bits of colored light reaching his bed like dark hands from the past, offering gems. And death is coming fast.
We who burrow in filth every day may be forgiven the one sin that ends all sins. The more lucid and overwhelming one's belief in God, the greater the temptation to get this over with. But how? Should a gentleman use a brace of pistols, one for each temple?
A lady should either take a lethal dose or drown like feeble, flabby, clumsy Ophelia. Falling. Falling is the supreme method, but you have to be careful. You don't want to hurt yourself or others. There's always the chance of taking with you an innocent walker, and his dog, too. A high back window would be safer, high enough to look down on another roof. A cat can be trusted to flush out of your way. Or a mountain. Here again, you'd have to choose carefully. Some fool of a crag might jump out and catch you, toss you, bounce you into a bush, mangled but unlucky to be alive. From an aircraft. Yes. That would be best. Your muscles relaxed. Your parachute shuffled off, shrugged away. And down you go. Slow motion somersault. Sprawled on the eiderdown of the air. You lazily turn to embrace your pillow. And now, I'll prepare for myself. Coffee. And a sandwich. Banana. Быть или не быть. Вот в этом вопрос. Что лучше для души? Терпеть прошлые стрелы яростного рока или на море бедствий ополчившись покончить с ними? Умереть, уснуть. Быть может, сны увидеть.
Hi, there's the rub. To sleep? Perhaps to dream?
Odon.
Odon! Odon, my friend! My very, very dearest friend!
It's good to see you, Charles.
Oh, and let me look at you. Oh, those eyes, those wondrous eyes. But tell me at once.
Tell you what?
That notorious actress with the awful hair. Did you marry her?
I did.
I forgive you. You're here, so of course I forgive you. You share my sandwich, banana with a sprinkling of sugar, like the ones we loved as boys. Antiza was here. Well, in a manner of speaking, we reminisced. At first I could only hear her, then I saw her. But I'm not sure I could have touched her. You, I can touch. Hold.
Charles.
Yes, my dear boy.
You must be strong. Remember, Charles the Beloved, after the revolution? Caged in a turret, the streets outside, foul with extremists and killers, boots and banners. But he refused to abdicate. He was king and would remain so.
Quite right. We spit in their eyes for the fun of it. And we must have a drink. Wine. I have wine here somewhere.
And you still have your Russian, I hear.
Oh, yes, yes. I can still translate Russian and English. English in Zemlan. Russian in Zemlan, English and Lettish English and Estonian, Russian and Hungarian. American and European, Polish and Russian, English and Albanian. English and Romanian. Czech and Russian, English and Russian. Zemlan and Russian.
It was a nasty time.
Very. Rooms in the palace that had once smelled of carnation, lilac, now goat and greasy leather.
Arrests and executions?
Denouncement, interrogation, pronouncement, defenestration.
Much of the city went on as ever. Most of the streets were safe enough.
Yes, I was told the cafes were full, as was the Royal Theatre.
I was giving my time on. The sun's a thief, and with his great attraction robs the vast sea. The moon's an arrant thief.
I missed that performance.
Previous engagement.
Mm-hmm. And offstage you went disguised as a thuggish guard stationed in the palace so you could watch out for your king, your friend. masterly. Hmm? You made the real thug look like an amateur actor.
The king, my friend, in his high turret cage. Defiant.
Haughty. But they didn't keep him there too long. They moved him to a dismal place in the basement. Little more than a lumber room. And there, alone, despondent, he suddenly remembered he had been here before. 30 years before. With Oleg. You never met Oleg. He was a regular faunlet. Black buckle shoes, white ankle socks, very tight indigo shorts, very short. Every time he turned up, he had a tulip in his hand, or that's how I remember him. And he and the king, 30 years ago, in this very lumber room, discovered a secret passage at the back of a cupboard full of old toys too young for us. We'd already been allowed to share a bed. Oleg led the way. We did have a torch, but I remember I seemed to be following more those shapely indigo buttocks than the feeble light. He had an erect radiance of his own that seemed to illumine the low ceiling, the crowding walls. He led me out of the palace a mile or more, over stone and mud, round pools of ditch water, through dusky smells of earth and turf, the sound of dripping, the sound of nothing, under terraces and mansions, streets and parks, all the way to the Royal Theatre. And he led me all the way back to a hot, steamy bath. By then we were both in a manly state and moaning like doves. He died at 15, a toboggan accident. Many years later, when the king was escaping alone by that same tunnel, all alone, he found a footprint. Only one. Oleg's footprint. As immortal as the tracks of an Egyptian child, made 30 centuries ago on bricks drying in the sun by the Nile. Immortal.
Brothers, sisters, masqueraders all, I have to tell you that our beloved king, two nights ago, was arrested by extremist police. Oh. Within an hour, he had been released. Hooray! He was able to convince those uniformed apes that he was one of us. A pretender, a prankster disguised as a king. They said they already had 100 clowning kings in their cells and sent him on his way. Thank God for the stupidity of tyrants. Brothers and sisters, we are everywhere. In the towns and the hills and the forests, in our red sweaters and red caps. And now, the king's pursuers are as bewildered as they are stupid. Ours is a new kind of resistance. The resistance of mischief and mirrors. We clowns, good people, we clowns and mimics, we artists have brought a tyranny to disarray. Hooray! So I can tell you the king is on his way, here to Rippleson Caves. And from here, that sleek and powerful motorboat will take him to the safety of exile. But temporary exile. Our king will return. And while he is away, the thespian rebels of Ziembla will fight on, play on, laugh on. He will be with us soon. Peasants and artisans, barons and blacksmiths and farmers' sons, they have all succored him and guided him on his way. He has waded waist deep through bracken. He has climbed heathery slopes and steep ladders of rock. Once, dear friends,
he came to a pool to drink. And as he approached, he saw his own reflection, red-sweatered, red-capped, come to meet him. But this red looking-glass king didn't stop when he did. Then did stop. They stood for a few moments, as in loving, dreadful heart-stopped recognition. Until one king turned and vanished, while the other remained. Charles, are you asleep? You should move. Go to bed now. Bed, Charles.
I'd love to, dear boy. But I've so much work to do. What is that funny creaking? Do you hear?
It is the shutter on the stairs, my dear. If you're not sleeping, let's turn on the light.
I hate that wind.
Let's play some chess.
All right. I'm sure it's not the shutter. There, again.
It is a tendril fingering the pane.
What glided on the roof and made that thud?
It is old winter tumbling in the mud.
And now, what shall I do? My knight is pinned.
Who rides so late in the night and the wind? It is the writer's grief. It is the wild March wind. It is the father with his child. Later came minutes, hours, whole days at last, when she'd be absent from our thoughts. So fast did life, the woolly caterpillar, run. We went to Italy, sprawled in the sun.
And is that the jacaranda tree you had in mind?
What do you mean?
You don't remember? I was to escape from my own palace in disguise, come here to your villa and climb that tree to your window. I was to live a Zemblan legend.
And now that's just what you're doing. You've lost weight.
I've lost a kingdom.
You must eat properly. Did you get my letters?
While I was still their prisoner? Indirectly. They were read aloud to me by the palace commandant. One of them, it would seem, was translated from your governess English into Zemlan by a Hindu or Eskimo member of the extremist party. The translation was comically inept. One line, "I want you to know that no matter how much you hurt me, you cannot hurt my love," came out as, "I desire you and love when you flog me."
I do love you, Charles.
They are all buffoons and rogues. But I am escaped. I am translated. Thanks in large part to Odon.
Oh, he's in Paris, is he not? Directing a film.
Is he? Or is he, in undisguised truth, back in Zimbla, directing the resistance, master of disguise and misdirection? I must be going. It's been a pleasure to see you again, Isa. I do admire your jacket, and your hairdo is most becoming.
Charles, listen, why not stay here?
I must be going. It's been a pleasure to see you.
Kiss me.
Isa.
Yes?
I dream of you.
I dream about you.
But I never dreamed of you before. And these dreams are... they could rend the heart. You see, in the dream you are you, but I am not I. I am other. These dreams are... a migraine threatens.
Stay here with me.
A man may come here, deceive him, lie to him about where I'm going. He has a wart on his chin and black hair on his hands. He may call himself Jack de Gris, de Grey, Dargus, Vinogradus, Leningradus, or simply Gradus. Lie to him.
About where you're going? I don't know where you're going.
To America. To teach at the university.
Teach? But how?
Unseemly for a monarch. Even an exiled king. I don't think I ever told you this, but years ago in Anjava, I used to lecture under an assumed name, wig and false whiskers and everything. So, to examine masterpieces with charming young people, a hobby, a passion I can now freely indulge. And here's a thing. The university I'm to lecture at. John Shade's there.
Shade?
Yes. He wrote that poem you loved.
the sacred tree?
John Shade.
He is a genius. I'm longing to meet him.
Charles.
He'll be my poet.
In the paper, yesterday, I think, I knew the name meant. John Shade, he's had a heart attack. They doubt if he'll survive.
Oh. Well, there are always other poets.
I was dead. I don't know how I knew, but I knew I'd crossed the border. But when I told the doctor what I'd seen...
What you'd seen?
He told me no one could hallucinate or dream in the state he'd found me. Not that I admit it was a dream. He agreed my heart might have stopped, but when I insisted I'd been dead, he said, not quite, just half a shade.
What did you see?
Well, you'll have to wait for the poem.
How long?
Can't tell.
Won't tell.
Take the last 24 hours. I put in, let's say, 1,000 minutes of work, produce 50 lines. What's that? A syllable every 2 minutes? Hard work, Charlie. Charlie?
How long?
I can't say.
I don't know how long I can...
Come on. Let's get home.
I really don't know. King Charles, the beloved. He arrived here by aeroplane, then parachute, green silk. A car was waiting, Rolls Royce.
Charlie, this king of yours, how do we know all this?
For there are those mysterious moments when, too weary to delete, I drop my pen. I ambulate, and by some mute command the right word flutes and perches on my hand. My best time is the morning, my preferred season midsummer. I once overheard myself awakening while half of me still slept in bed. I tore my spirit free and caught up with myself. Upon the lawn where clover leaves cupped the topaz of dawn, and where Shade stood in nightshirt and one shoe. And then I realized that this half, too, was fast asleep. Both laughed, and I woke safe in my bed as day its eggshell broke, and robins walked and stopped, and on the damp gemmed turf a brown shoe lay. My secret stamp, the shade impress, the mystery inborn. Mirages, miracles, midsummer morn.
Are you all right?
I am perfectly well, Mrs. Shade. I have been working very hard, perhaps not quite the labor that produces a syllable every 2 minutes, but nevertheless, labor.
Might we open the shades? It's a wonderfully sunny morning.
If you don't mind, no. I find lamplight more conducive to concentration. May I ask why you're here?
I don't know. I really do not. One self had to drag my other self here. But we have to reach some kind of accommodation with each other.
I see little chance of that. You have disliked and distrusted me from the first. Why, I do not know, given my admiration and affection for your husband's work and for John Shade himself, given the help I tried to be to him. Then you turn up here and accuse me of being little more than a voyeur, an eavesdropper, a parasitic elephant and tick.
What an absurd phrase.
I would have been his friend. I would have lavished friendship on him.
Dr. Kinfolt, let's calm down.
Lavished material to make a masterpiece.
Let's accommodate.
But much of it seems to have survived no further than his first draft, which I believe he burned. I saw him myself one morning burning a whole stack of cards.
That's what he did. With all early drafts he no longer needed.
But at whose urging? Who made him burn away almost all traces of Zembla? Who, Mrs. Shade?
Tell me about Zembla.
I was a loyal friend, and someone, Mrs. Shade, saw to it I was not even invited to his birthday party.
We didn't ask you because we knew how tedious you find such get-togethers.
Oh, lame. How feeble and lame. And did he wear my present?
He had little chance.
Would he have worn it?
Well, to be honest...
Oh, by all means, let's be honest. It was utterly gorgeous. Utterly silk. A dressing gown fit for a samurai. And July 5th is my birthday, too.
Oh.
Oh. Oh, indeed. I am weary of this. I am weary of it all. I think you should leave.
Listen to me for a moment.
I am weary of moments.
You once overheard John make a remark.
Old eavesdropper Kinboat.
No, you inadvertently heard. One night at a college dinner, he said something about turning over a new leaf with the left hand.
I remember. Someone had been talking about the old man at the Exton railway station. Thought he was God. Started redirecting all the trains.
The word loony was used. And John said, no, that wasn't the word. Not for someone who peels away a drab and unhappy past and replaces it with a brilliant invention.
Turns over a new leaf with the left hand, yes. And wasn't there something about the old man being a fellow poet?
They weren't talking about the old man at the station. John was talking about you.
John Shade called me a fellow poet?
Not exactly. Someone said that seemed to be what he was suggesting, and he just put his head to the side and puffed on his pipe.
Yes, I can see him. Good heavens, a fellow... But I didn't have a drab and unhappy past.
I want to know, Dr. Kinboat. I want to know what he saw in you. He spoke about you sometimes with exasperation, with, let's continue to be honest, a weary groan.
Did he?
But sometimes there was, I don't know, a kind of wonder.
My story is wonderful. My past, no drabness there. Unhappiness, yes, at the end, but my past is a time and place of wonders.
Zembla, tell me about Zembla.
I cannot. It could only be told to John and could only be truly told through his verse.
Then at least tell me about this assassin of yours.
Gredos. He left Zembla on your husband's birthday. He'd been chosen by the turn of a card, but there is a suspicion the deck had been fixed. He arrived in New York on the 20th of July. He stayed one night in the Beaverland Hotel, and by the next afternoon he was a new wife. That evening, he found his way to Dulwich Road, where you and John and I all lived.
How do you know all this?
I visited him in prison.
How did you manage that?
I have influence here and there. I can be persuasive. When he knew what I already knew, he had to confess the rest.
He's dead.
Gredos.
Jack Gray. His name was Jack Gray.
He has many names. Gredos Gray, Dargus de Gris.
He cut his own throat with a safety razor.
Уснуть. Быть может, сны увидеть. Да вот где затвор.
Russian. You are fluent in Russian.
When I was a child, there was quite a vogue for Russia at the Zemlan court.
You teach mythology, legends, Germanic, Scandinavian, Russian.
Not the Russia of tyrants and Philistines, that of gentlemen, ladies of liberal aspiration. Gone now. It might be a dream, a fiction, that Russia.
I dreamed about you last night. I saw you descending under your parachute of green silk. Then you shuffled it off. The parachute, you shrugged it off, but didn't fall any faster. Still slowly, as if suspended by, well, the dream. A slow-motion somersault down and down.
Sprawled on the eiderdown of the air.
That's a quote.
I dream only of my wife.
We didn't know you'd been married.
I still am. I married Disa in 1949. She lives in Nice.
How long since you've seen her?
Last year, very briefly.
You're estranged, then?
We always have been. I never did love her. I told her so once, told her I didn't, could not love her. She went down on her knees, down on the tiles, like a charwoman. But in these dreams, I do love her, I mean. And I have to tell her I do. It's imperative. I have to take back what I said. I must lift her to her feet and take it all back, and everything will be changed. Everybody will be happy. She'll be happy. These dreams are purer than my life. I feel love for her, admiration. Well, even awake, I always admired her. And I feel pity. John's password. So I have to find her and tell her, but I can't reach her. There are lots of people between me and her, if she's really there at all. Notes are passed through the crowd to me. She's not available. She's overseeing a bonfire. She's married to an American businessman. She's become a character in a novel. She's understudy for some queen in a tragic play. She's dead. And then I wake up, and I don't love her at all. By the time I've showered and had my first coffee, I'm as casual and indifferent as ever. She looks like you.
Like me?
Not as you are now. She looks like the portrait of you in your husband's poem. Lines, if I remember, 261 to 267. The glistening teeth, careful lip, long lashes and peach down, hair brushed up from temple and nape. Now, this picture may be idealized.
It may be what?
Stylized, let's say. But in those lines, I recognize only Disa. Of her, it's a startling likeness. Is that not strange?
Yes, it is. I've yet to dream about John. Sometimes it's hard to recall his face.
I see him with perfect clarity. Just as I can see Gradus. Not the suicidal wretch in the prison morgue. No, no, the new one.
New one?
Oh, yes. There is another Gradus. There is always a Gradus. He will be dispatched soon. He has already set out. He has bought a ticket, boarded a bus, a plane, a ship. He has landed. He's walking, implacably walking towards that door, my door. Any moment now, he will knock at my door. Any moment. I am weary of moments.
Dr. Kimball, please.
This Gradus is bigger, more respectable, more competent. Not an unshaven lout. This one is regal. Not a gun this time. No missing this time. A razor, and not a safety razor. The old-fashioned cutthroat kind, elegant and gleaming, like the one I use myself, which I brought all the way from Zimbla in its velvet-lined walnut case. And that hand won't tremble, not like this hand. That hand will be steady and true. Do you believe me? Do you believe me at last?
Yes, I believe you.
And then I'll cross the border John has crossed before me, to that land where I will be again as a king in Zimbla. Death, Mrs. Shade, will be for me a restoration.
I believe you. Would you do something for me?
What?
Read me part of the poem. I take it you do still have it here.
I have it. It's safe.
I'm not going to try to take it from you. How could I?
You could not.
Fetch it, then.
I don't have to fetch it. It's here. 20 cards in the left pocket. 20 in the right. In the left breast inside 20 more, the remainder in the right.
You've been wearing it.
I did for days when I first got hold of it.
You went about plated with poetry.
Armored with rhymes.
Bulletproof. Read to me.
Read what?
The last 30 lines or so. John never had the chance.
I haven't studied the ending myself. I've skimmed it.
Read it now.
I am not a performer.
Please.
Very well. Where are we? Richly rhymed life. From here, then. Line 971. I feel I understand existence, or at least a minute part of my existence, only through my art. And if my private universe scans right, so does the verse of galaxies divine, which I suspect is an iambic line that is very beautiful.
Yes, it is.
I'm reasonably sure that we survive, and that my darling somewhere is alive.
Oh, John.
Should I go on? As I am reasonably sure that I shall wake at 6 tomorrow on July the 22nd, 1959, and that the day, of course he did not, but the line must remain, and that the day will probably be fine. So this alarm clock, let me set myself, yawn, and put Shade's poems on their shelf. That's not the end.
No.
It goes on. But it's not bedtime yet. The sun attains all Dr. Sutton's last two window panes. The man must be, what, 80, 82? Was twice my age, the year I married you. Where are you?
I was in the garden.
In the garden. I can see part of your shadow near the shagbark tree. He was inordinately fond of that tree.
He'd known it since they were lads together.
Yes, he used just the same words to me. Never one to underuse a good conversational line. The shagbark tree. Somewhere horseshoes are being tossed. Click, clunk, leaning against its lamppost like a drunk. Lamppost? What lamppost?
Picture a horseshoe that's been flung. It's hit the post. It's half upright there.
Ah. We never did find out where those horseshoe sounds came from. You could hear them every other evening, but you could never be sure. We could hear them that night. He'd finished the poem.
A few trifles to settle, Charlie. That's all. And then, by God, I've smung it. By God.
That's it there. The envelope. Where is the missus?
Her club. Dinner meeting.
A suggestion. There's half a gallon of Tokai at my place. I'll share my favorite wine with my favorite poet. If you share with me, and I'll divulge to you at last who it is who gave you your theme.
What theme? Oh, right. Well, I think I guessed this secret of yours a while ago. But I'll sample your wine, Charlie.
So we set off from your porch to my house.
Judge Goldsworth's house.
Shall I go on?
Yes.
A dark Vanessa with a crimson band wheels in the low sun, settles on... It was still there when we were crossing to my house.
What was?
The butterfly. It came whirling round us like a little flame.
Look at that beauty.
Then it settled on his sleeve.
Oh, my beauty. My admirable girl. There you are.
He spoke to it as if it had sought him out.
Maybe it did.
You share his fanciful notions about the creatures. Anyway, it took off again, disappeared, and we carried on towards my house.
You have a visitor.
What visitor?
There, on your porch with a suitcase.
No, I'll kill him.
Who is he?
They delivered tracts. They threatened to be back to explain God's purpose. I'll kill him.
We'll get rid of him.
Tonight of all nights.
He's coming to meet you. What's he?
No.
Come on, Charlie, this way.
Kratos, no.
Charlie!
John.
No!
John.
My assassin, Kratos, he missed me. He killed your husband.
His name was Jack Gray, a homicidal lunatic. He'd escaped from an asylum. It was Judge Goldsworth who put him there. Gray mistook my husband for the judge.
He crossed half the world to kill a king. There are only a few lines more. Wheels in the low sun, settles on the sand, and shows its ink-blue wingtips flecked with white. And through the flowing shade and ebbing light, a man, unheedful of the butterfly, some neighbor's gardener, I guess, goes by, trundling an empty barrow up the lane. John, of course, knew it was my gardener. Who else in that neighborhood had a black gardener? And John had seen him many times. I think what he's doing here with this vagueness is to give a bloom of remoteness to familiar things.
A Negro boy pushing a wheelbarrow, a clockwork toy. John was watching it when he had his first attack.
Near the end of Canto 1.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the end of Canto 4. Pattern.
Yes. Pattern.
I would have made the connection, of course, when I read the passage closely.
I'm sure.
That was the last line. Trundling an empty barrow up the lane.
Is it? Dr. Kinboat, I want you to finish your commentary.
You do?
Mm.
Well, no matter who does or doesn't want me to continue...
I think John would have liked to read what you produce. And when it's done, the manuscript of the poem is to be lodged with the Library of Congress. You agree?
Well, of course. That was already my plan.
Professor Hurley will then be free to produce his own edition.
I must publish first.
I promise you, neither I nor Paul will make any attempt to stop you from publishing.
Very well.
I'll say good day now. Goodbye, Dr. Kinboat.
Mrs. Shade, do you ever consider the strangeness of reading, of writing?
The strangeness?
They are miracles. And yet we take them so for granted. But it's as strange as if a butterfly weaving and dipping, as if it were making signs in the air, signs we can decode. Miracle. It should make us gasp every time we read.
John used to tell his students they should gasp not only at what they read, but at the miracle of its being readable.
Did he? Mm. I didn't know that. Strange.
There is a strangeness here, and we should see it through.
Trundling an empty barrow up the lane. Not the most resonant of final lines.
Not final. No. Not final.
A man, unheedful of the butterfly, some neighbor's gardener, I guess, goes by, trundling an empty barrow up the lane.
I was the shadow of the waxwing slain by the false azure of the windowpane. I was the smudge of ashen fluff, and I lived on, flew on, in the reflected sky.
In Pale Fire, Charles Kinboat was played by Finlay Welsh. John Shade was played by Angus McInnes, Sybil Shade by Joanna Tope, Professor Hurley by Crawford Logan, Ordon by Richard Greenwood, and Deezer by Gayan Potter. Pale Fire was dramatised by Robert Forrest from the novel by Vladimir Nabokov and directed by Patrick Rayner.